Katie.
I'm Erica.
And this is Book Talk.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Erica.
Welcome to the last section of The Rabbit Hutch. This is Book Talk Podcast. Katie, what the heck happened in this book? By the way, spoilers coming. We're about to talk about the ending.
We wrap up all of our storylines in this last section, starting with Blandine and James. If you'll remember from the last section, it ends with Blandine rescuing a goat and James, of course, being the one to show up and pick her up. They take the goat back to the apartment where Blandine leaves the goat so she can have one last final conversation with James. After they have their kind of back and forth, she runs back in to see the boys almost sacrificing the goat because at this point they have been progressively sacrificing animals. Blandine jumps in to save the goat, ends up getting stabbed herself, but she does not die, even though this is the scene we were building up to where she exits her body. We realize in the coming scenes when she's in the hospital that nobody knows about her and James, so he is going to get away completely free with nobody knowing about the inappropriate relationship that they had. While this is happening, we get it from a couple different perspectives as well. We get to visit Joan in her apartment. She hears this blood-curdling scream of Blandine, but as she's locked herself inside, waiting to make sure no one breaks in after Penny warned her about a man watching her apartment, she doesn't go and do anything, but later visits Blandine in the hospital. We also see Moses, who was going to come, planning to attack Joan, ends up going to the wrong door and rescuing Blandine instead. So it's all coming together. And the last story we hear is Ida and Reggie, who go to drop off the mouse at the people's house. And on the way, he follows the screams of Blandine again. So really connecting everybody together, these terrified screams. And the book ends with an exchange between Joan and Blandine at the hospital, where Joan says, "You're awake." And Blandine responds to her, "I am. Are you?" Which I thought was the perfect way to end this.
We did it.
We made it. What did you think of this last section of the book in general? Thoughts, feels, comments?
I liked this last section. I'm glad we got a lengthy discussion between James and Blandine. I don't know, and we'll talk about this more with Hannah, our guest. I don't know if it's confirmed that nothing's going to happen to James. It definitely seems like his ex-wife is suspicious about the way he was talking about Blandine before and then how he's talking about her now. She sort of like has a scent of blood. So we don't know necessarily that nothing happens. We also don't know what Blandine's going to do when she gets out of the hospital now that we know that she's alive. But I liked this last section.
Me too. I guess I meant that he got divorced and left his wife without having Blandine being the main cause of that. Whether he'll have repercussions in the future, I think is yet to be determined, but that was not why he left his marriage. At least that's not how he presented it to her, because she seems to not have that confirmed yet.
I really liked this book. I finished reading it while I was on vacation, and I like was running through this last section to figure out what happened. I'm glad Blandine survived. I'm glad the boys weren't intending to attack her. I thought that also was a good kind of twist. It was almost in self-defense, and I hope that helps them maybe not suffer so much of repercussions for this. And I thought the ending was sweet that Joan and Blandine connect, because we really began the story with the two of them in the laundromat, and I'm glad it ends with them having a real sense of connection to each other.
I loved that too. I thought that was a very sweet way to end it. I'm glad Blandine didn't die. I'm glad the boys didn't decide to sacrifice her. That is what I thought was going to happen. And I thought exiting her body was for sure her going to be, that was it for Blandine. So I was glad that it was not. I think my overall feelings of this book is that I liked it and I enjoyed Blandine's story. I did feel a little bit like the author was using these characters and their being inside their conscious and their overthinking to kind of have monologues of her own thoughts. I feel like she definitely has something to say. I can tell that she has something to say. She clearly has the talent to say it. I felt like she was a little bit processing like gender roles and capitalism and like all of these big things through her characters, like monologues throughout. So I thought that was fine, but I think when you do that, the plot kind of got lost. And there was a lot of things where I'm like, okay, I just feel like that wasn't necessary multiple times throughout the book. But I still think when she did get on these monologues, especially inside Blandine's head, I think they were thought-provoking. The way that we get to see her process things was very relatable to me. I think I could see myself going back through and reading those sections again, like when Blandine and James are talking and seeing how she processed it and how she's kind of viewing the world. This specific thing that happened to her in the larger view of the world.
I agree. And Blandine's thoughts, the way you're describing them in these big, long soliloquies and perfectly comprised arguments that she's having with herself about big constructs like capitalism, that part just doesn't feel relatable or realistic. That's not how my thoughts sound. My thoughts is just like chaos, things being thrown up against the wall, random things popping up, random intrusive thoughts. It just is not as coherent as Blandine's thoughts. And I think that's part of the book, part of the challenge of this book, is trying to relate to this character Blandine, who seems like a Tumblr post come to life almost.
Yes, I feel like the whole book is just jam-packed with metaphors and one-liners and like explorations of these very like meta concepts. And while I appreciate them all, I feel like I could read these quotes scrolling through a Pinterest page or a Tumblr or something, and it's good and you could understand it. But I just feel like I don't know that it was tied together enough for me to give it a 5-star, but I still enjoyed the book and the plot and the character development and being inside their heads. But I just want to list off these side characters, like Ida and Reggie. We get like 2 pages with them. The mom and her husband, Anthony, were at the motel, but they were never back. The only real connection for them is they live in the apartment and Moses stayed in that same motel room. We have this kind of deep dive into Moses and Elsie and the movie stars. We never come back to that. Elsie has no point in this story. We don't even really get any kind of revisiting of the developers, kind of, through TVs, but it just seems kind of lazily put together.
I disagree with the assessment that the couple story didn't wrap up, because I think the couple is an example where they do take each other seriously. And when she finally does share these deep thoughts that she's been having with her husband, that like, my baby's eyes are creepy, he basically is like, yeah, babies have creepy eyes. Like, that's totally fine. I've actually already thought about the possibility that you're really suffering and that you need medication. I've already budgeted it out for you. I've talked to people about how we can get you this support. And also, isn't it funny that not only does he have creepy eyes, but he has your eyes, babe. LOL. And I think that's just like it was a perfect example of what Blandine and Joan are missing, which is someone taking them seriously. It's like we have this one couple who is seeing each other and are able to successfully connect. And I think that's part of what their character story is telling us.
I see what you're saying, and I think that the couple has a very sweet story. I think you almost have to backfill that in, though. Like, what is the point of this, and what is the overall theme of the book, and then how can I fit these stories into the theme of it? I think you should dig a little bit deeper, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's how we process books and then figure out how these stories really do have a larger meaning than what's happening to us one-on-one. So I don't disagree.
Yes, it's definitely a thinker of a book. You have to digest it, I think, for it to make sense, and that's not the easiest book, but I do think I think she was very thoughtful. I will say that it's very clear Tess thought a lot about this book. It was heavily edited. It was clear she's written a lot of drafts. She probably included 50 other characters who didn't make it. I think there was a lot of strategy in this book that doesn't make it the easiest or most obvious book to read. It's definitely a thinker.
I would read this book over a 2-week long vacation and also read it in paperback or in a physical book, not a Kindle, because I think it would have also been more helpful if I'd had the physical copy to go back and forth in and kind of maybe put together a couple of those thought points a little bit more clearly inside my own head while reading it. But overall, I thought it was really good. And at the beginning, I wasn't sure I would like it. And I did.
My favorite scene comes at the end when Blandine and James are finally hashing it out. They're saying everything they thought. They're not saying what they think. They're getting their emotions out. They're not getting their emotions out. And what we are left with is Blandine's central struggle, or what she's really up against, which is she's so obsessed with these nuns or these saints, people who've had these really deep religious experiences, because she can't find it in herself. She can't find it in life. And she's desperately seeking that meaning, that sense of rightness, that devotion from these, you know, characters that she's been reading about. So when she's talking to James, she says, "I just wish, sometimes I look out at my life, everything I've seen so far, and it all looks so, so grotesque. I look for the virtue. I don't see any. I'm dying for any proof of it, you know, proof of something good, something like divinity, but I don't see it. I look at my life and I see this warehouse of gargoyles. Why do vices get to be physical? Why do they get to clutter up the world? Why can't I see any fucking virtues?" And this is the part that makes her cry the hardest. just like such a powerful, profound crisis that I've definitely personally been through. It definitely feels like an early 20s sense of everything's meaningless and nothing's meaningless and everything has, you know, meaning and is imbued with importance, and also nothing is at the same time. And it's just that kind of pull of everybody else seems to have meaning and devotion and I have none. And where is this answer for me? How do I find it and how do I create it?
And also I feel like the things that she feels and sees most clearly are what has happened to her, the vices, the bad. That's so much more physical. I thought was such a powerful way to explain that the vices are physical, both the virtues you have to know. And we see Reggie talk about this too when he looks at his wife who he was enamored with, and he's like, is this love? Is this what is that? I want proof that this is what that is, that this has all not been for nothing. And that proof is always just a little bit out of reach. But I thought it was a really powerful sentiment. Blandine's entire argument with James is extremely powerful, articulate, incredibly intelligent, and that's why I feel like it doesn't feel as realistic. But of course, same kind of like in Lessons with Chemistry, right? That is explained away as her being just incredibly smart. And of course, like, this person has all these thoughts is just existing kind of a small town. I don't know if that made sense.
I mean, she does seem less articulate when she's arguing with James. It's clear she can't quite say what she means, and then sometimes she says things and he's like, well, that's not true.
Oh my god,
like,
I love
well,
it he,
actually
yeah.
You didn't read that text close enough.
He's
like,
clearly
sorry,
read some Wikipedia pages, but you could try a little harder to dig into the next groupings of works here. That is true. One thing I wish this book would have done in a more grounded way was talk about the struggles of these kind of Rust Belt or neglected towns. I think Vacaville becomes a character, but it's a little bit kind of like the rest of writing, a little bit atmospheric, a little bit out there. And I wish we could have heard a little bit more about that specific setting for this book from the characters besides Blandine. I think she has kind of a more refined view of it than I think the other characters do. But I don't know if you felt the same way reading about that.
I don't know. I get a sense of the town. I think you get the story of why the town is the way it is. You know, this reminds me of a Detroit or another big city that had a really thriving production line, or, you know, some thriving industry that's now defunct, that's now left and taken all the money with it and the jobs and the young people and the life. And, you know, it's kind of who remains, and the neglect of the town as it's kind of falling apart and being overdeveloped.
Actually, as I'm thinking of that, I think that you're probably right, because even inside those Rust Belt towns, like, everyone has a nuanced way that neglect and kind of the decline of these towns is affecting them, and it's not always so on the nose. So I take it back.
One of the aspects, or one of the side character ideas that I didn't totally get, is I don't know why we needed these three guys. I don't know if this is like a biblical allegory or what they each represented, but I really think you could have combined Todd's, or you could have had just Todd and Malik. I don't think we needed another one. You have like the indifferent one, Malik, and then the narrator, I think his name is Nick. And
Jack.
Again, see, I can't even keep them straight. I don't really know why we had all three of them, or what they added, or how they added a uniqueness. Maybe you just need three guys to get a really bad idea and to start acting on it. I don't know.
Maybe there's something. Jack is the one she had that kind of momentary romantic connection with. I don't know. I think the three kind of makes it seem more likely that they would do something like sacrifice animals without kind of talking about it, because you're kind of like one of the group then. If you're the third person, it's not just you and another person making this decision. It's like you're kind of following along, not knowing what the other two think. So I think there's a little bit of maybe of a group think aspect to it than there would be if there was just two of them.
Maybe.
I don't know. Just a thought. No idea. Why'd you get three of them? Also, we get to know so little about them.
Right. And we know very little about the resolution of what happens after Blandine is stabbed. So now we have these three guys who, yeah, okay, went off the rails a little bit. Okay, maybe a lot of it. But what's going to happen to them after this? What's going to happen to James? What's going to happen to Blandine? What's going to happen to Moses? I feel like it kind of ended abruptly and let us put those pieces together, which usually I like. But in this case, I guess I was looking for a little bit more, maybe an epilogue of what happens next. We talk about this again with Hannah too, or she mentions it at least, that some of this lends itself well to a movie or television series. And if that happens, I hope they spend a little bit more time in the after, you know, after the hospital. Does Blandine go home? How does she make sense of all of this? You know, how does her connection with Joan evolve? Does it stay? Does she stay in Vaca Vale? Does she continue with her plot of foiling these developers? Does she move on? We don't know.
I agree. There are hundreds of plot points that I feel like did not get resolved in this. And this whole book takes place over 1 week in July. And we obviously get to be inside of a lot of these characters' brains, which I enjoy. But I feel like the fact that it took place over 1 week and it's all kind of left unresolved, I just don't think that the plot was the strong suit in this book pulling you through. But the character study was, and being inside these characters' heads was. But the plot is just, I feel like this is where it's locking to at the end, throughout and at the end. It's just not enough. I wanted more from her, and I feel like it's right there. I'm like, just tell me what happens with all of these people.
You don't sound like you liked the book.
I didn't like the book the same way that I like books that are plot-based, where I feel like I read it and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so fun and so entertaining. But I did really resonate, it really resonated with me, the inter-processing of the things that happened with Blandine. And I like it the same way I liked Open Water, or books that are very poetic and atmospheric in nature. I think the writing is beautiful and there's an appreciation there, like when I read poetry or something, that is different than how I appreciate novels. So I think that I'm frustrated that there wasn't enough plot in it, but I still think that the level of writing and the level of experimenting with the consciousness of them and of Blandine processing was still beautiful enough that I liked reading it.
Or there was too much plot.
Yeah, it's just not refined enough. I just feel like the plot wasn't, it wasn't enough. Whether that there was too much plot, it wasn't refined enough. The tensions weren't there. It was kind of a backseat to being inside these characters' heads.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a character forward book for sure.
Right. So I enjoyed that part, but I just think that we could have, maybe she could have done both. Again, I'll pick up whatever Tess writes next. And maybe it'll be a little more connected. I do think it was interesting, we'll talk about this a little bit later, how books who win awards or who are praised highly in the literary community, that this is sometimes true of them. That they are kind of pushing the envelope, that they're very ambitious, the writing is stunning, and maybe the plot or what's happening or how that part is written is less important.
Yeah, I don't know. It came. I think the plot makes it. The plot came together for me. It's not a... I think this is very clearly a hero's journey. I think Blandine is our hero. We're reading about the tragedy of what she's been through and how other people have treated her and how she is going to emerge in the end, fighting for her life, fighting against, you know, her roommate who's trying to kill this animal that she rescued, that she carried with her back to her home in its wounded state. And she survives. And she not only survives, she connects with Joan in a sense indicating that she has achieved some level of awareness or some sense, she's found some sense of devotion or meaning for herself in that tragedy. So I think it does have a cohesive message and storyline, but there's a lot around that. There's a lot of intellectualizing around that that maybe can distract from that core message.
Yes, I feel like we said earlier, this book is a thinker, and sometimes I feel like I'm just not on the intellectual level to appreciate books like this, and also sometimes I read a lot of books to just enjoy it as kind of a way, a media of escaping, because I don't watch as much TV, and so sometimes when I have to be like really on my A game of reading through this intellectualization of someone's existence, it can be a little bit less of a five-star book read for me, but I think people read books for different reasons, so yeah. Okay. I don't know. Sometimes I do feel like books like this, I'm like, I'm not smart enough to get it. I don't know what's going on. Or it would just take me a long time to get it. Like if I was to write an essay after reading it, and if I were to like take time processing each of her lines of each sentence that Blandine relates back to capitalism, then I probably get some deeper meaning out of it. But when I'm just reading a book for fun, I feel like this one maybe just required a little bit more thought. And that's not better or worse. I think it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah, it's just different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, after the break, we're going to be joined by our special guest to talk more about her perspective on this book and the themes and get her take on this crazy, crazy book.
Hi, so I'm Hannah. I am the founder and creator of Bookmark Party, which is a book blog, social community, and e-commerce store. I started Bookmark Party in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic when, like a lot of people, I was just stuck at home and needed a creative outlet. So I started posting on Instagram, book reviews and recommendations, mostly for my friends and family. And little did I know there was already a whole online book community. So I became a part of the Bookstagram community, and then I joined BookTok later on, and I also launched an e-commerce store last year, which you can find on my website at bookmarkparty.com, and my e-commerce store features a lot of my literary-themed art and merchandise and gifts made specifically for book lovers. So that's Bookmark Party.
Well, thank you so much for being here to talk to us about The Rabbit Hutch. So our first question is that popular novels and books about the Midwest usually focus on a very small and specific demographic. These usually tend to be undereducated, working class white people. And this book takes a similar perspective on a dying, neglected small town. But to borrow from one of our favorite phrases in the novel, it takes their characters very seriously. And all of our set of characters are given a really rich set of emotional settings and history about them. Which of the characters that we meet in this book resonated with you the most? And what do you think about the larger character of Vaca Vale as our setting?
Okay, so my favorite character was definitely Blonadine because she was the most intellectually stimulating, and she definitely had that kind of like pixie girl, you know, liberal snowflake sort of quality to her, but also just very intelligent and thought-provoking. And I feel like a lot of the kind of rabbit holes, if you will, that she went down were really just made me think a lot more than I would have if she didn't like overthink everything that happened to her. So I really did enjoy that character. And I think she's the one that really made the book so fascinating to me. And I also think the way that the author characterized the town was really fascinating as well, because it really did become a character in the book. And I also think Blonadine's relationship to the town and how she was kind of like sabotaging, you know, efforts to modernize was really fascinating. And I could really kind of see her perspective, but at the same time, I mean, if I lived in a dying town, I would want to modernize it and, you know, bring it into the future. So it was really interesting to see that kind of like dichotomy of her kind of desire to keep things the same, but also just kind of where the town was at and where it needed to go, if that makes sense.
I agree. Like I was saying earlier, I live in Ohio. A lot of my family is from the Rust Belt areas in like northern and southern Ohio. And I think there is this, like, just like you're saying, the dichotomy of wanting to kind of hold on to the good parts, the charming parts of like what used to be, but also needing to move into the future in some way. And that kind of like push and pull, like, how do we do that and still keep the identity of what it used to be? And I also like the part about the way that Blandine thinks, and I don't know how you say her name, FYI, I'm just making this up too, but how she's like kind of chaotically overthinking everything. I feel like I can do that in my brain. It's interesting to read that out loud, somebody's like processing of everything that's happening in her day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think Blonadine reminded me a bit of myself in that way, because I am a massive overthinker. And so kind of just reading through her thought processes and also just the way that, you know, one little minor thing can happen and it kind of turns into this whole tailspin of, oh, well, this leads to this and this leads to this, and just kind of like these almost like existential questions I found really fascinating. But I also wanted to touch on your point about, you know, wanting to modernize and just kind of, you know, real life example. I live in Austin and I grew up in Austin. And when I was growing up here, Austin was more of a small town and like, you know, had a lot of funky hole in the wall spots. And now it's become much more of a big city. I think it's like the 15th or 17th largest city in the United States. And a lot of the locals that have been here for years and years have very complex and mixed feelings about the fact that Austin's turning into such a bigger city and there's so many more like apartment complexes and office buildings rather than just a lot of kind of unique, funky, again, hole in the wall places that can't afford the rent any longer and are getting pushed out in favor of larger developments. So I definitely kind of recognized some of, you know, my experience just with living in, I mean, Austin was never a dying town, but just a modernizing city and kind of recognizing that push and pull of what different people want from their city.
And that does seem like what Blandine is resisting is like sapping what's great about Vacaville out of it through like developing these like flimsy, lacking character apartments in contrast to something that she really believes in, which is like this open nature area and the like natural kind of wildness of Vacaville, and that's what she sees is being sort of destroyed by these developers. So I think she's cherishing something similar to what you're saying, like the heart and the character of the town, which is being kind of leached out of it.
Exactly.
Okay, one of my favorite parts of the novel is that it's told from multiple perspectives. So we get to be inside the chaotic and sometimes terrifying conscious of a lot of different humans. What did you think of this type of format and storytelling? Did it all come together for you in the end?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think at the beginning, I was a little bit confused as to how all these characters were possibly going to be related, especially the glow man. he certainly seemed like the odd man out, but, you know, he did come around in the end and play a role in, you know, the other characters' lives. So I always find books that are told from multiple perspectives and are told in such a way that you don't really know how everything's going to come together and how everybody's going to be interrelated. I always find those books uniquely fascinating just because it keeps you interested and engaged. And I also think sometimes the author doesn't do perhaps the best job of really intertwining everybody, but that was certainly not the case with this book. I think she really did do an excellent job of tying together everyone's experiences. And also I think once I realized that a lot of the characters were living in the same building, which probably took me longer to catch on to than it should have, that kind of made a lot of things make more sense as well.
Is there any part of these different stories that didn't come together for you? Like, is there any kind of loose ends from the plot?
You know, I can't think of a specific character or a loose end, really. I mean, I maybe would have liked to see a little bit more of Blandine, kind of just more of her confrontation with James when she kind of realized that, you know, he was essentially a predator and that she wasn't the first person that he had, you know, pursued in an inappropriate relationship. So, I mean, I feel like she did kind of do her own reckoning. And I also appreciated that part of the story because it did feel very realistic. You know, I myself have never had that sort of relationship, but I imagine as, you know, a teen who is going through something like that, you probably don't know as you're doing it, like, oh, this is, they're preying on me. This is a relationship that is inappropriate. Like, she felt like she was in love with him. She like cared for him and thought that he felt the same way. So I did appreciate how the way that story was told, it did feel very realistic to me. But I would have liked to see a bit more of Blandine essentially just like really giving it to James in terms of like telling him what's what and putting him in his place. But other than that, I really do think the author did quite a good job of kind of tying everything together. But I'm curious to hear what you guys thought since you've read the book more recently than I have.
Yeah, that actually made me think, I kind of wish James got more of his like comeuppance, maybe not from Blandine, but maybe from someone else. He doesn't really have any cosmic justice for what he did in the end. He seems like on amicable terms with his ex-wife, and he's pretty much just going to leave Blandine and go back into his life, it seems like. He doesn't really exhibit any remorse. He's still kind of gaslighting her about what she's pretty sure is true, that he has done this before. And that probably would have been satisfying if, like, somehow he maybe learned or grew or even had just some, like, genuine empathy and sorrow. And maybe some people did get that from the last scene when he's talking to Blandine, but, you know, I kind of wanted him to get punished a little bit more.
I agree. I think that I agree with everything about James. Like, he deserved more than he got. I'm not even sure that his wife really knew. Sorry, this cat. Okay. I'm not even sure if James's wife really knew that it was Blandine. Do you think that she knew? Because at the end, they're talking, and she just seems to be like, did you know her well? Like, after she got stabbed, did you really talk to her? You should connect it with your students. So I feel like James got in the divorce and out of the marriage and basically out of here scot-free. Like, nothing happened to him. He didn't even have to admit it to anybody except for Blandine that he might have made a mistake. So I agree, he did not get what he deserved in that aspect. I think that she ties the stories together in this book, but I think there are a couple that for me felt a little bit like a loose end, including the Glow Man story. I feel like we could have taken that entire plot out and I would have been fine. He came around at the end, but it wasn't in an important role, really. I mean, I guess he did open the door and help Blandine in that last moment, but I think it could have been somebody else. Like, it didn't need to be him. And I think that sometimes the book can feel very atmospheric and you're inside their brain, so it's hard to know that they're all in the same apartment complex. You have to kind of, like, read between the lines. You have to realize you're reading apartment numbers when you see C4, C10, and C12. She doesn't make it very obvious that these characters are interconnected. You have to kind of go the extra step to do that for yourself, which I think can be a little bit harder and why people figure it out sooner. And it takes, you know, took me a lot longer as well to be like, oh, she lives right below them. That's how connected they are. That's what wall they share.
Yeah, I definitely agree that the Glow Man was a little bit kind of threw me for a loop. He definitely was the most bizarre aspect, I think, of the story. However, I kind of appreciated that just because it was so just out of left field and, like, just so not what you've, or at least not what I've ever read in a book, and just so out there that it did intrigue me. And that was definitely one of my, like, WTF moments. Like, who is this dude and why does he do this? But yeah, I mean, his storyline definitely, I mean, had she taken that out, everything still would have made sense. You're right. Somebody else could have discovered her at the end, but I did kind of like that that ended up being his tie-in and that it happened to be like, oh, he came to the wrong apartment and, like, happens to save this girl's life.
You also kind of are waiting with Joan as she's, like, taking melatonin, watching her, like, nature show or whatever as she's going to bed, because you think, oh, he's going to break in at any moment into her apartment. And that's, like, a fun bit of surprise and almost like a release of tension. I guess that's one of the roles that his character plays. It's like it brings some levity to an otherwise pretty dark book. He does have dark parts as well. So in that way, he does feel, like, fully formed. He's not just there as, like, a joker. But his name's Moses, the Glow Man. I do think it was a nice redemption story for him because we saw his more negative tendencies. And then in the end, he swoops in and does the right thing, even, you know, covered in glow sticks.
Imagine his surprise when he walks into that instead.
I also think that if this book were adapted into a movie or series, that character and that kind of visual of him coming in covered in glow sticks kind of to save the day would be a really interesting visual experience.
Definitely. Speaking of things being interconnected, we really believe that at its core, The Rabbit Hutch is a story about our connection to each other and realizing how intertwined our lives really are. One of the lines that we keep going back to is a line, I'd wish we take each other a little bit more seriously, which is something Blandine says. How does this need for connectedness contrast with our need or our tendency, especially as Americans, to be individuals or to operate kind of in an isolated fashion?
Yeah, and I think that's a really, really interesting and introspective question. I mean, I think in today's day and age, it's very interesting in that everybody wants to be an individual and everyone wants to be seen for their unique self, right? And that's why the rise of social media has gone as it has and why you know, TikTok and Instagram and this kind of curated or more raw, like on TikTok, people kind of like to show their raw, authentic selves. And even Twitter, you know, people like to broadcast their every thought. So I definitely think it's interesting to kind of examine how society, but Americans in general, like to be seen as individuals, but also part of social media is a way to connect with other people and, you know, to share your opinion, but then also feel a sense of empathy or connectedness with somebody who's like, oh, I felt that exact same way. And I think that that's kind of becoming more the norm. I think like when social media first started out, and especially with Instagram and Twitter, it was more of, you know, setting yourself apart from others in a way that almost made you superior. And, you know, Instagram was much more of like the highlight reel. Where I think now with TikTok becoming more mainstream and just kind of that more raw, unfiltered type of content, and, you know, you'll get on TikTok and you'll see people crying on camera about something that happened to them and sharing like a traumatic story. And it's much more kind of realistic versus just, oh, my life's so great. Like, here I am in Bali. Like, here I am, you know, getting a promotion, or here's my beautiful baby. So I think it's kind of interesting the way that that change has happened. And I think part of it is probably due to the fact that, you know, social media is a big contributor to people's decline in mental health, because nobody wants to see somebody's perfect feed and think, oh, well, my life's not like that, so what's wrong with me? So I personally have been really encouraged by this kind of new direction that social media seems to be going. And I think this book really kind of almost exemplifies why that's important.
I agree. I think as we've gotten into more of the digital age, it has brought people further apart. And now people are kind of realizing that connectedness to other people is necessary. It was something we took for granted before. And now I feel like everyone's kind of trying to, it's almost come full circle, and everyone's seeking that out, like a way to connect with people online, to expand their circles of support, et cetera. So I too like the good that social media can have in that way.
I also think that the pandemic has probably played a role in kind of that just shift in the way that people feel about social media, their relationship to social media, what they feel inclined to post on social media. Just because obviously when everybody was, sheltering in place and couldn't go out and socialize in person like they usually would, they were forced to rely on other means to have a social life, especially people who lived alone or, you know, didn't have family members or roommates to interact with. So I think also just with the pandemic, you know, we saw a rise in mental health diagnoses, and, you know, there was a huge rise in the number of prescriptions written for antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications. And I think that probably contributed to people seeking out more authentic connections on social media, just because they weren't able to get that in their IRL life. So I definitely think that that probably had an impact, but I do think, at least in my opinion, that was one of the, you know, benefits, if you will, of the pandemic and kind of how things have shifted since then.
It also kind of reminds me of living in New York, in a big apartment complex where it's almost like the rabbit hutch, where you sort of can hear everything that's going on. You know, sort of your neighbors, you sort of know their life story. You know, you see people come and go that they're dating, you see their pizza boxes when they got like delivery the night before, etc. But at the same time, we don't have that same connection with our neighbors that maybe our parents' generation had, where like, I don't have their phone numbers. I don't know, like, if I needed sugar, I would probably just go to the store and get it. I wouldn't like knock on my neighbor's door to ask them for something. So I do think social media has helped with accessing community online, but in some way we've also exchanged that for sort of an in-person connection that people used to have. And I think it's a question like whether those are actual substitutes for one another. And I don't know. I hope that as the world's opening back up, we still kind of go back to finding those in-person connections as well. But I'm a social scientist, so it's also an empirical question how this will play out. But also I just have to say hilarious because I'm literally wearing a hoodie that says Be Authentic on it right now. So it's funny that you mentioned that.
Were you influenced by that on social media?
Actually, James got this for me, Katie.
All right, fine. That didn't work out as planned.
I think that's also interesting because it really kind of goes back to the theme of modernization and kind of, you know, development. And, you know, you mentioned you wouldn't go to your neighbors for a cup of sugar, but it's also like back in our parents' generation, they didn't have the option to just go on Instacart or, you know, Amazon Now something that could be at their doorstep in, you know, a few hours. So I think like that also kind of plays into not just social media, but also just kind of like the modernization of both society and cities and just society in general. And I'm sure as a social scientist, that's something that's very interesting for you to ponder.
Okay, someone on Goodreads called Blandine a manic pixie dream girl times 1,000 in reference to how eccentric, intelligent, and quote-unquote cool she was. What did you think of Blandine originally, and how did your feelings about her evolve as you read her story?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think my thoughts about her at the beginning were kind of just, oh, she's very whimsical and gosh, I don't even know how to put into words how I felt about her, but definitely pixie dream girl is a good summary. Like, I think I would probably describe her as a snowflake of some sort who just is very unique, but also perhaps not very rooted in real life, just kind of lives in her own world, kind of. But the more I got to know her and the more we got to see her thought process and, you know, again, just kind of how she would, how one thing would happen or someone would say one thing and it would take her on this whole kind of journey of what this one comment or what this one action meant and kind of just like the repercussions of it or what it, where her brain went when something happened was really interesting to me. And just made her feel a lot more relatable and also just intellectual. I definitely think some of the things that she kind of went down in terms of just various kind of tangents she would go on when she would be having a conversation with someone and it would turn into a whole other discussion than what it started out as, I found really interesting because a lot of the questions she asked, and I wish I could think of a specific example at the moment, but sadly that is eluding me. But she just asked some really interesting questions that I myself would then sit and be like, oh, that's a really interesting thought. And what do I think about that? And a lot of them kind of had to do with, you know, existentialism and or kind of human existence and just our role in the world and our relationships to each other. And, you know, again, as we were talking about our connectedness and individualism. So I feel like by the end of the book, I was like, wow, she's brilliant. And yes, she is this very kind of like elusive, you know, maybe kind of head in the clouds creature, but she's also somebody that is just probably too intelligent and too thoughtful to really connect and be understood by the majority of people.
Yeah, she's definitely, I mean, we know this, that she belongs at like an elite institution. They've like tell her that multiple times that like you're destined for greatness. You should go to, you know, a top university. They would love to have you and to sort of like put her amazing brain power to work. And that leads us to our next question, because that path is ultimately stolen or derailed for her because of this relationship with her teacher, James. What did you think about this relationship between James and, as we know, her name truly is Tiffany? And how cliche they were kind of in this relationship and how aware they were about how cliche this relationship was. Do you think the relationship was handled well by Tess? Kind of what are your feelings around that part of the story?
I mean, I definitely think that she handled it as well as any quote unquote an inappropriate relationship could be handled. And I definitely think she portrayed it in a very realistic way, at least, you know, again, as somebody who hasn't experienced that firsthand, I do think she did a good job of really encapsulating what I imagine the feelings of a teenager would be if they were going through something similar to that. you know, because she did think that like they were in love, and she did think that this was this really special connection, and she didn't view it as something that was inappropriate or that she was a victim. She felt like she was choosing this, and she felt very in control of her choices, at least up until the point when they ultimately slept together. And then he kind of almost gave her like the cold shoulder, or just wasn't as like nurturing and sweet as I think she expected him to be. And I think that was the moment that she realized, oh, this isn't what I thought it was, which I also think was, is probably very realistic. But it also just kind of made me really feel for her, and just, it was sad, you know, and that's always sad to hear any girl in any relationship feeling, unwanted or feeling rejected, whether it's an appropriate relationship or an inappropriate relationship. But especially in this instance, it was just kind of that moment for me that was almost full circle of her being like, oh, this is not okay. And her realizing, you know, almost just kind of the extent of just not only the fact that he's her teacher, but also the age difference and the fact that he's married and she's at his home while his wife is out of town. And I just kind of feel like the way that was written, I really felt kind of what I imagined the author wanted us to feel in terms of how Blondine felt in that moment of just like, oh gosh, like this isn't what I thought it was. So I definitely found the relationship intriguing and well-written. Again, I think the only thing that could have been perhaps improved upon was in the end, I would have liked to see Blondine either, you know, be able to reprimand him more in some way and really put him in his place, or on the flip side, have him forced to deal with his actions either because his wife found out or the school found out, or I don't know, just him being punished in some more concrete way.
Yeah, I'm even confused, like, talking about it now with what I would have wanted for Blondine, because you want her to leave this town and to, like, you know, she would love it in LA or Austin or New York City. But at the same time, she feels so deeply for this place, and it's really the only sort of home that she knows is essentially this like park or open field area where she feels like she can go and be safe. And I don't want to take that from her either. So it's like you want Blondine to escape, to get out of the hospital, you know, to enroll in a great university, to start her career as a prolific philosopher or what have you. And at the same time, you still want her to find peace in Vaca Vale. And maybe that's why we don't have a resolution with her and James. We don't know where she eventually goes, because it's sort of up to us to think what would be ideal in our minds for our girl, Blondine.
I was trying to find, that's why I hate reading on a Kindle, because I was like literally just hitting the next button. In fact, this section where they're talking in the car, I'm not going to be able to find it now. And this is why I'm not reading on a Kindle, because I can't post it note mark what I want to remember to say. But I think that I was proud of her for a lot of the way she's able to articulate her feelings and the evolution of their relationship, and how she tries to be like, you know, it was so cliche. I could see it coming. Maybe I should have taken some responsibility. I mean, I am aware of what was going on, but also in the end coming around to the fact that at the end of the day, the power dynamics are outside of her control. No matter how much she thought she loved him or thought she was making a conscious decision, it wasn't hers to make. And he talks about the responsibility of it. But I agree with what both of you are saying about what we want for Blondine is what she wants for herself. And also that James did not get what he deserved in it. You mentioned throughout the book that you had that the book had a lot of WTF moments. I know we talked about one of them already, but which one was your favorite and least favorite?
Yeah, so, I mean, the glow man was definitely perhaps the most intriguing, I'll say. I think one of the other things that kind of had me just reeling in my mind, like, what is going on, was definitely the first chapter and kind of, like, how we see Blondine, like, basically experiencing her town outside of her body. And obviously it comes full circle at the end of the book when, you know, she obviously has this near-death experience. But at the beginning of the book, I was like, what is going on? Is this like a sci-fi book? Like, I'm so confused. So that was definitely something that I think at first was just confused, but also intrigued, because, I mean, I at least love sci-fi. So I was like, all right, well, this might be going a different direction than I thought, but okay. So that was definitely one of them for me. I also think the sacrificing of the animals was definitely a WTF moment for me, and probably my least favorite, just because, you know, any sort of animal cruelty is difficult to read about or hear about. But yeah, I also just kind of didn't really understand how the roommates got to that point where they were feeling like sacrificing animals and murdering animals was something that they just like needed to do. That just kind of felt a little bizarre. And I mean, I guess it ultimately resulted in, you know, the conclusion of the story with Blondine trying to come in and save the animal and ending up getting stabbed herself. But yeah, I don't know. I just found that part of the story a little bit strange.
Yeah. Yeah, I was kind of confused too. I think towards in the last section, Malik is filming it to like go viral online. And I kind of wish he had been doing that all along, because that would sort of make more sense if he's like trying to create these viral shocking videos and that's like the impetus for them escalating violence against each other or animals or even just like trying riskier and riskier things to sort of get some internet fame. I think that's something that like very clearly goes against something that Blandine wants. It goes against like the type of attention she would give him. And that just kind of comes out of nowhere at the very end. So I agree with you. It didn't really make sense why they were sacrificing animals to begin with. I think she probably could have like tied that together a little bit better. I know a lot of our listeners and in past books we've read, people have issues with any kind of mention of animal cruelty. So it does seem like very kind of unnecessary.
I agree. This is one of the things where I feel like she did not wrap the stories together well. Like, this is a theme throughout it. And I think that we know it keeps happening. We kind of understand the boys have like a pact about it, but it ends up being a crucial turning point to this story. And I feel like we were kind of just thrown into it. Like there's no, I wasn't expecting, I mean, I knew she was going to exit her body in some way, but I couldn't have known that it was going to be Malik filming it, that it was going to be a larger animal, like, because there's nothing to lead you to that conclusion. It's just kind of like sprinkled throughout. And then it ends up being this crucial turning point in the story. So I didn't love that either. I feel like it was a little bit thrown in as a plot point.
I'm trying to remember the name of this movie. Oh, okay. So I think you guys made a really interesting point. Erica, you mentioned that one of the characters is filming it and he's like trying to achieve internet fame, even though it's through something that's horrible. I mean, in their right mind would want to be famous for harming animals? That sounds horrible to me. But anyway, I think it goes back to this kind of idea that our society is just wanting to achieve fame or recognition really at any cost. And there's this film that came out recently on Hulu called Not Okay. And it's a fictional movie, but it's about this girl who pretends, she starts posting doctored photos on her Instagram of her in Paris, like pretending she went to Paris. And then while she is like supposed to be there, when really she's sitting at home in her New York apartment, there's a terrorist attack in Paris. And so she like pretends that she was there and is a survivor of this Paris attack and, you know, becomes like a voice of just against violence and gun violence in particular. And, you know, eventually it comes out that she was faking the whole time and she has to deal with the repercussions of that. But I think it, both that movie and this particular plot point brings up a really interesting topic and just something to think about of how people are so just excited about and for whatever reason want to be known, even if it's for the worst of reasons, and are just willing to kind of do whatever they can to achieve even just 15 minutes of fame, which I don't know how we got to that or why, you know, that's a human desire, but whatever the reason, it's definitely something that rang true for me, at least, and just kind of different experiences, both with film and television and, you know, real life news stories.
Yeah, if anybody can stomach it, because it's intense, but there's a documentary called Don't Fuck with Cats, and it's about someone who is like engaging in animal abuse for views. And basically the internet is like, absolutely not. We're going to band together to like find this person. It's a true story. Find this person and punish them and like get them arrested for animal cruelty. It's an interesting documentary of how like you can go viral for a lot of things online, but animal abuse people will not tolerate, which is, it's a good thing. I don't know. Malik didn't get that memo when he was trying to film this attack.
I watched that documentary when it first came out, and it was very haunting. I feel like I was just like very disturbed, and I didn't necessarily have nightmares about it, but it was one of those things that I would just like lay in bed like thinking about, and it's just like not thoughts you want in your head before you're trying to go to sleep, because it is very disturbing. And like, I'm not a true crime junkie, I'm not somebody that really has the stomach for that, but I watch it with a friend, and it's just so riveting. And the way that, like you said, this kind of, it's like a Facebook community, they band together and they're like, we're gonna solve this crime, and they're like figuring out based on like, you know, the door handles and the videos and like the wallpaper, like where this guy is and like how to find him and things that like the police and detectives are missing. So that aspect of the story I found really fascinating, and I feel like that's why I just like couldn't stop watching. So I was like, well, like, are they gonna solve the crime? Like, what happens? But it definitely is not for the faint of heart, because it is quite disturbing. But definitely, you know, again, if you can stomach it, something that is quite fascinating.
Yeah, not for Katie. That's the face she's making.
I can tell you right now that that's not for me. Half the books Erica reads, I'm like, okay, do you think I would like it? Someone recommended a movie to me last night, and I was like, am I going to love it? And they're like, no, it's not for you. It's for the others in this group chat. It's not you. I'm like, okay, as long as you know, I won't be doing it.
Katie's like a no scary movies, no gore, like, yeah, no excessive violence. Yeah.
I feel like I'm a little bit like that. I typically avoid, I mean, at least if it's a fictional story, I'm a little bit more okay with it. But anything that has to do with serial killers or, you know, like a rapist or something that's just like really graphic, I can't do that. Occasionally I can read a book that involves those sort of content or that kind of subject matter, but visually watching it on screen to me is a whole different experience. And I just like can't stomach that.
And I'm like, the world is already traumatic. Why do I have to watch it in my free time as well? How awful people can be. But reading about it, there is a little bit more of a disconnect. I feel like I can stomach a lot more. I mean, I have almost like died reading a book Erica made me read about cannibalism. But other than that, I feel like I handle it pretty well if it's in print compared to visual.
I actually just finished reading A Little Life. And I'm not sure if you guys have read that one, but I'm sure you at least know of it. But yeah, that's one that I feel like contains basically every trigger warning you can think of. And reading about it, again, like you said, there's like a little bit more distance or like, I don't know, it's just like not as in your face with the visuals because you're imagining it. So I feel like that would be something that would be really hard to watch on screen because there's just so much abuse and trauma and like violence. And to somebody that's so just, you know, sweet and harmless and just undeserving of that sort of treatment. So yeah, I think because of that, there are some books that just like shouldn't be made into, you know, screen experiences because we just don't need to see that.
Yeah, it's surprising that you mention A Little Life because I think that's a book that's pretty popular or at least talked about on Book Talk a lot. And I have read it. I remember the visceral emotional reactions I was having to that book, but I could actually tell you very little about the characters and the plot of that book. Somehow that part really didn't stay with me. All I remember was just like the emotional devastation of reading it. Whereas with The Rabbit Hutch, I really feel like Blandine, Moses, James, Joan, like these are characters who I feel like I really got to know separate from the tragedies that were happening to them. And I think it will stick with me more versus other books that also have kind of a heavy subject matter. So that actually also leads into our next question, which is, what's your overall rating of The Rabbit Hutch out of 5 stars?
Yeah, so I think I rated it 4.5 stars. I think I originally rated it 4 stars, and then as I was kind of writing my Goodreads review, I ended up, you know, upping it a half star, at least on my Instagram review, since you can't do half stars on Goodreads, just because of how unique it was and the fact that it really did make me think. And like you said, it really is a book where the characters stick with you. At least for me, I think Blondine really stuck with me. And like, again, just the way that her brain worked and the way she thought about things was really just intriguing to me. And so she, as a character, has really stuck with me. I think some of the other characters I sort of forgot about, for instance, the Glow Man, I forgot about him until you guys mentioned him. But now that I'm remembering him, I'm like, oh yeah, that was like a really unique and like memorable character. So yeah, I definitely think part of my rating was because this book really did get me thinking and it was very thought provoking. It also, in terms of subjects that I think we as humans and a society need to contemplate more. So I definitely enjoyed that aspect of it. And, you know, I also enjoyed the fact that it did come together, you know, pretty well in the end, just in terms of looping together all these different characters with different backstories. But I am curious to know how you guys rated it. And I also am curious to know, since I'm sure you guys know that this book won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2022. So I'm curious to know whether or not you guys felt that it was deserving of that award.
Wow, throwing the questions back at us. Okay. yeah, I would give this book 4.5 out of 5 stars as well. Maybe 4 stars. I loved it. I thought it was so sweet. I think the tragedy of Blandine, Tiffany, will definitely stay with me. And her pain, her depth of feeling, her depth of thought, I really resonated. And then I think just the overall theme of neglect, of, you know, irreverence, of ignoring the connection and how important people are to each other, I think that'll stick with me. I think I read better books in 2022. Like, I wouldn't say this was one of the best books I've read. I don't think it'll be one of the best books I'll read in 2023, but I liked it. I think critics look for something different in books than what Katie and I look for. We definitely want a book that challenges us, that helps us think about things in a new way, and that brings us into a new perspective. But literary critics are sometimes like very off base with a book that I like, and they really like a book that's like really out there. I'm thinking of like Sheila Hetty's book that I read, where I was just like, what the fuck did I just read? This was like an intellectual exercise in like navel gazing. And it was just like, this is a new Bible. And you're like, I don't get what I just, some people were living on a leaf. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. That is like what happens in the book. So I don't think average person's taste and critics' taste always align, I guess is what I would say. And this book, I think, is very expertly crafted, and I can see why it has some critics' appeal as well. You can definitely tell, like, she got her MFA. Like, we get it, Tess. It was very, like, very well written, and these, like, soliloquies and paragraphs of, like, Blandine's really deep thoughts, I think is what critics really liked. And this is a case where I tend to agree with them, but it's not always true for me.
I would agree with that. I think at the very beginning, the first section of this book, I was like, I feel like I'm reading the Oscars version of books, right? Which is kind of how I feel about the National Book Award in this case as well. I think that when I watch Oscars and my friends, they're like, okay, with the lighting and the costumes and the way that this thing makes you feel. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not fully interested in this movie the whole time. And also, it's 4 hours long. And that's a little bit how I felt about this book. I think that, like you said, it's obvious that Tess is an incredibly intelligent and talented writer. I think I will probably read whatever she writes next based on that alone, because I think that her writing is beautiful and thought-provoking throughout. I think the monologues or the internal kind of train of thought inside of her characters is beautiful and thought-provoking. I wrote down many lines as I was reading it that I would like come back to. And I think Blandine's processing specifically of events that have happened to her and how she feels was beautiful. And I could see me picking the book back up again for that. I think for me, I would say 4 out of 5, because I just feel like the plot felt disconnected. Like, a lot of it felt underdeveloped for me, not Blandine's story, but like the mother and the baby's eyes. Like, we hear about her 3 times, but there's no real reason for that except for to just show that multiple people live in this apartment complex with different issues and different struggles. And I feel like there might have been a better way to do that Same thing with the Glow Man and the Joan. It just felt like not connected enough for me to be bought into this cast of characters. But I think Blandine's story and the roommate's story saved it. And if the book could have just been about that and her interaction with James and his family, I think it would have been enough for me and maybe even felt a little bit more tied together. But I did love it. I thought that it was a beautiful portrayal of this small town.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear you mention some of the kind of peripheral characters, because I read this book back in, I think, October. And so some of the kind of fringe characters aren't top of mind. So to me, I'm remembering Blandine, the roommates, like kind of the most critical prominent characters. So I perhaps can't speak as well to whether or not, you know, the fringe characters tied in as well as perhaps they should have. But I don't know. I also kind of sometimes enjoy a subtle tie-in. And again, if it's like every character only has this very vague, like barely connected storyline, that would be a little bit much. But I don't know. I felt like, and again, it's not top of mind, so there are perhaps characters I'm forgetting, but I did kind of appreciate that at least a couple of the characters, like the woman who goes to visit her at the end, how she wasn't really in the book that much, but she got to play kind of an important and interesting role. So yeah, I don't know. I found that interesting.
I totally agree. Speaking of the National Book Awards, what else are you reading right now? Is there any other books that you'd recommend to our listeners? Anything wonderful you've read lately that you would recommend?
Yeah. So I was trying to think of books that I would recommend that are kind of similar to this one. So if people like The Rabbit Hutch, they might also enjoy, you know, another book. And the thing that's coming to mind is actually the winner of the 2022 Booker Prize, which was The Seven Moons of Molly Almeida. I think that's how you say it, which is a very ambitious book. And again, one that I feel like had lots of WTF moments for me, but also was very thought provoking and, you know, helped me learn a lot. It is a story that is both fantasy, but also historical fiction. So basically, like, super quick summary, it's about a gay photographer in Sri Lanka who wakes up dead, and is in the afterlife or the in-between life, and is going through this sort of like purgatory and learning about his life and what has become of the people he left behind and these kind of like secrets he was trying to protect. So it really is about both this kind of fantastical afterlife, but also it really delves into Sri Lankan politics and just kind of what's going on in terms of like their civil war. And I feel like because of that, it was like a little bit harder for me to sometimes follow because I'm not personally very familiar with the landscape of Sri Lankan politics. But it was really interesting. And, you know, just the fantasy part of it alone, I found really thought provoking and just kind of, I'm always interested to see how people imagine the afterlife because it's obviously such a, you know, elusive concept, and could be really, I mean, at least in my opinion, anything, because we just don't know, you know? So I really did like the way he imagined that. And, again, I think it's a book that critics probably loved, but readers perhaps maybe wouldn't rate it as highly just because it is very ambitious in scope and it is a lot to digest just between like kind of following all the fantasy elements, but also kind of like understanding what's happening politically and just like culturally with the landscape of where it takes place. But it is, you know, especially if people like to read books that have won literary prizes, it's definitely one that I would recommend. Also for people that liked The Rabbit Hutch.
I'm adding it to my list.
That honestly sounds great. I might read it too.
Another thing I would maybe recommend, and this is kind of something I've just been trying to do for the month of January, because I feel like since I started book blogging back in 2020, there have been a number of books that, you know, I constantly hear people talk about or, you know, came out several decades ago and I just haven't gotten around to reading them. But I'm like, as somebody that is now very involved in the literary community, I feel like I need to read these books. So for the month of this January, I've only been reading backlist books. which has been a really fun kind of exercise for me. And a couple of the ones I enjoyed the most were The Red Tent, which I don't know if you guys have read that. It came out in 1997, and it's a reimagining of a woman who's just briefly mentioned in the Bible. And it basically, she's, I think, Jacob's daughter, who obviously plays a big role in the Bible. And she's very briefly mentioned, and the author creates this whole, like, extravagant backstory that takes place over generations for her. And that book reminded me, I mean, just like a little bit in the way that this story is about so many different characters and how they all like connect in the end, like that kind of reminded me of The Red Tent a little bit as we were discussing. But again, it's also just kind of, I don't know, I like the aspect of it being sort of a biblical story without being a biblical story, if that makes sense. So yeah, I would definitely recommend that one, especially if people enjoy books that are really about, like, you know, women power and women taking control of their destinies and smart women, which, you know, I definitely think Blondadine falls into that category, even though she, you know, fell into something that wasn't ideal. Many women, unfortunately, have to deal with unfortunate events, but, you know, end up coming out the other side, sometimes better for it, sometimes not. But regardless, it's an interesting thing to just experience through their eyes.
Perfect. Amazing suggestions.
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us today. It was lovely to talk to you and hear your perspectives on the book. It was great.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for inviting me. This was so much fun, and I'm so glad I got to meet you guys. And I'm definitely going to be listening to your podcast going forward. So you've got a new adoring listener.
Oh, yay. I can't wait.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thanks so much, and have a great week.
Speaking of over-intellectualizing something, I finished The Candy House.
Yes, I was curious what you thought of that. What was the premise of it? And also, did it win some awards?
No, it might win some awards, I can see. The premise is it's sort of a dystopian near future where there's this technology that you can access, where you can upload your consciousness to the cloud, essentially. And if you do that, you then have access to other people's memories and can watch these like gray memories of people who have uploaded it. So you can see why there's like obviously a lot of incentives to do this. However,
it's kind of like a Black Mirror episode.
Yes, that's what I thought. Because this is like how it's branded as like, this is like, there's the tech genius who comes up with this idea, then there's people who use it in a different way. That is so like irrelevant to the majority of what you're reading. Every chapter is a different character, every single chapter, and the characters are sort of jumping time. We talk about this in last week's episode, where you meet this person when they're a child, and then you meet them when they're an adult, and then you meet their kids, and then you meet their friend, and then you meet this other person. And I found it as much of a thinker of the rabbit hutch, but more, and then very difficult to get what the point of any of it was. She is sort of critiquing technology, but not really. The technology's not really explained, so it's not really a sci-fi or like a Black Mirror episode, because like that part is just like not really discussed that much. And then you don't spend longer than, you know, 20 pages with any single character, so some of them are memorable, but overall it just really felt very overwrought to me. So that's probably also why I really like The Rabbit Hutch and why I'm defending it so much, is because, like, you want to talk about over-intellectualized. I mean, that book was, like, so dense. I need someone to walk through every single chapter and, like, explain the point of it. I really didn't get the point of the book, which is really a shame because I like Jennifer Egan. I just did not get this book at all.
There's so much to be said for what other books you're reading at the same time that you are reading another one and how that affects it. I'm reading The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo and Spare, both of which are very grounded, very much like, this is the plot. This is what happened. Here is how I felt about it. And so in comparison to reading a very intellectual book like The Rabbit Hutch, it stands out in contrast in the opposite way, how I assume it does for you reading something that you feel like is more over-intellectualized in a worse way.
And it's, again, like a big cast, but you never go back to any of the cast. And that part's really challenging because you feel like you connect with one of them and then they're gone. Or you connect with one of them and then you see, you know, their child dealing with them as a parent. And so it's this very different way of looking at things.
How weird. All right.
I'm now reading this book I got on my Kindle that I think you've read too, The Southern Guide to Killing Vampires? Southern Book Club's Guide to Killing Vampires?
I did not read that.
Oh. Hold on. Let me see what it's actually called. It's about this book club of Southern moms who... Oh, it's called The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. Yeah. And so these like four moms start their own book club and they decide to read sort of more illicit books about murder and cults and true crime and romance. You know, the books that are a little bit too lowbrow for or too salacious for their other book club. And then this all gets challenged when our main character is attacked by a vampire. And we then meet her great nephew, who I'm assuming is a vampire and is here to sort of seduce these moms.
Where did you find this book?
Someone recommended it. I don't know who. If it wasn't you, it must have been somebody else on Instagram. It's a very, like, delightful, kind of fun, cheeky book. The author starts basically being like, I wrote this book because of X. And, like, I want you to get out of this, like, how these women are sort of, like, isolated and alone. And what are they going to do when this, like, super charming, hot vampire comes to town? They're going to roll the red carpet out for him. And it's kind of fun to, like, start a book that way and then... Now you meet them. So you know he's a vampire. You know he's like infiltrating this book club. You know he's already, or the main character has already been attacked by one vampire. So it's like, where is it going to go from here? We'll see.
Honestly, that sounds fun. I might want to read it next.
It definitely is like a book that you would like.
Okay, great. I need some books I would like next. I have read nothing new. I'm still finishing Spare and Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, both of which I'll probably finish this week. And then I'm excited to take a stack of books from my TBR pile that I have not started yet with me on vacation. So hopefully I can read a bunch there. The first one I'm going to pick up is Black Cake, which we talked about reading as a book talk book, if you remember. So hopefully my next set of books I read is more entertaining than this first month has been.
Are you not liking Seven Husbands?
I'm liking it. I think the issue was I was reading four books at the same time when I started it. I think when I pick that up, I'll probably finish it on the flight. I think it'll be great and it'll be reading like reading a movie. It's just I was trying to finish the 500 page love story book, reading The Rabbit Hutch and Spare and that at the same time. And I think I was just over my head and not obsessed with any of them. Right.
I think The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo also has sort of a lull in the middle and then it really will like pick up towards the second.
Right.
The
I think
last
I'm in
third.
The lull. I'm not mad at it. It's fine. I'm also loving reading Spare. So I'm liking them all. I just haven't had like a ton of time to read.
I also have downloaded Tana French's book, In the Woods. Have you read anything by Tana French?
No, but I've read a lot of good things about that book.
Yeah, it's highly highly rated, and it's like the first book in a series, so we'll see how I feel about that. Okay, well, see you all next week for our special episode.
Which I cannot wait for. See you next week.
Book Talk is made by me, Erica Bailey, and Katie Cheney, with production support from Dan White. Our theme music is by Dan White. We'll see you next week.